Welcome to the CRE Exchange Podcast, where we deep dive into the global trends and challenges of CRE professionals across all sectors of the commercial real estate industry. We engage with experts in the space to bring you innovative insights into industry practices, opportunities, and challenges to better inform your decisions. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate.
Welcome, everyone, to another exciting episode of CRE Exchange, a podcast about the latest news and trends in the U.S. commercial real estate market. I'm Colt Perry, your host and Associate Director of Research here at Altus Group, a leading provider of asset and fund intelligence. Today, I'm excited to have a special guest on. We have Christine Mastandrea. Christine Mastandrea is the president, co-founder, and COO of Whitestone REIT, where she leads operations, real estate development, portfolio optimization, and corporate growth strategies. Under her leadership, Whitestone has achieved record gains in occupancy, NOI, and FFO, delivering industry-leading shareholder returns. Christine, thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I know I gave a little brief overview of your bio, but how about you tell us a little about yourself, how you got into CRE, and how you ended up at Whitestone?
Oh, thank you. I think it all begins with my family. I grew up with a family of entrepreneurs, and my father was an entrepreneur. My grandparents were entrepreneurs. Many of my family members have formed businesses. It's like I came from in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's just the norm. With that, I've always found that I've had a real blessed career of being able to learn how to do certain things along the way. I'm also thankful for my parents and how they led me as a young adult, because both my parents on one side of the family, my father's family, he lost his father to an airplane crash, and they had a business that they built. And of course, because the major founders were killed in the crash, you know, you see what happens with the risk side. The same side on my mother's side, the family lost the farm. So, you know, you got to think about the epitome of things that you could build a business, but what can also destroy a business along with it helps you prepare to be a better business owner. That being said, early on, I think the best opportunity that I had was starting in the capital markets, and that was as a runner as exchanges. So in the early aughts, I was part of the Chicago Board of Options Exchange and the Board of Trade as well. With that, I learned very, very quickly how to have calm and presence and decision-making on the floor. So that always helped me when it came down to the speed of having to execute. But then at the same time, when I started moving up, I moved into the banking role, and I started to see with that, I started at Robert W. Baird after being on the exchanges. And with that, I learned a lot about how businesses are built, how businesses are profitable, what makes a business profitable. And then in addition to that, how to really sell the business, how to position the business to investors. So that point in time, when I came into the markets, the public markets, along that type of role, what was most interesting is you had the early REIT formation in the 90s. And along with the REIT formation, that was where I was starting to learn much more about commercial real estate. I didn't have as much experience with it, with the exception of my father collecting rents on duplex. But with that, you started to learn about this opportunity in the REIT space. And so at that point, I then moved over to the operating side of the business and got my ops jobs.
Excellent. And is that kind of growth of REITs in the 90s, is that the moment that drew you to CRE, or was it something else?
I think a part of it was the uniqueness of what was happening at that point in time. So in the early 90s, really the late 80s and the early 90s, there was a real challenge, I think, at that point in time with the S&L crisis. And at that point in time, there was a collapse in real estate pricing. And there was a challenge for figuring out what was the next opportunity for growth. And Sam Zell, who was very present at that point in time, was early in the stages of REIT formation. I was able to see some of the greats take what were at one point firms that were on the edge of dissolving and then positioning instead for the opportunity for growth by going public. So being able to go public saved a lot of these businesses. And at the same time as when they went public, that was when they were able to access public capital. And they were really, if you think about the Kimcos, the Simon Properties, all the multifamily REITs out there as well, industrial, so on and so forth. You just had this huge influx of formation of what at the time were private companies that were previous trouble for a couple of years before, had worked through restructurings, and then going public and having this tremendous opportunity for growth. It's a very exciting time to be in the REIT space.
Excellent. I want to step back a little bit and ask a little bit about your personal bio. One of the things I think is notable about you is your experience in education as a professor. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that, what got you into it, and what you're still teaching now?
Well, I teach in the Rice MBA School, and it's been a wonderful opportunity, number one, to be asked to teach, and another, it's a really great school. And then you get MBAs in their second year, so you have them where they're very curious about not only the product, but everything that they've learned in their first year. They're already starting to apply it in their second year. And it really steps up the challenge to be able to communicate value to them in their education. I'm fascinated also by this generation as it comes through, because this is the opportunity for us to discover what the next consumer looks like and what they're consuming and their perception of what's important to them, what they're looking for aspirationally. So I get just as much, I hope, from them as I give to them as well. What I give to them, I hope to get as much from them, because it's a really neat generation that I'm seeing from millennials on. Now I'm starting to get Gen Zs as well. So it's exciting. One of the things that I always hope to convey is the value in real estate. And also, how do you position strategically with an old line business? Where are the opportunities? So it's a little bit of using the vehicle of real estate, but also communicating a strategic direction and how to think differently and provide opportunities for the next generation.
I've got some questions about the generational shifts for you later on in the episode, so looking forward to that. But I do want to get to some specific questions about Whitestone. So you were named president in 2025, you're COO since 2022. You've been at the firm for a long time. So do you want to walk us through that journey, how you got started, what attracted you to the opportunity?
Well, this really coincided at the time when I was going for my MBA at Northwestern. And at that point, I always assumed that I'd go after school, I'd go back to the financial markets. I would go into private equity. I'd go back into banking of some kind of form or another. And what happened is at that point in my first year, and especially moving into my second year, our group was brought into a troubled group of assets. And it was an interesting hodgepodge of cats and dogs, I'd like to say. You know, we had about maybe $100 million in assets that were in kind of dire straits. They weren't being maintained well. It was declining cash flow. And not only that, it was a mix of suburban office, industrial, and then retail. Well, the suburban office is a commoditized product. And especially when you come into the South, there's just a plethora of six-story brown brick buildings. It's hard to distinguish out the product. And it's just hard to compete on anything but price. So that was one of those, like, do we want to go in that direction? I didn't really see the value proposition there. In addition, the industrial product wasn't dock high. It wasn't modernized, and it was not really operating. It was kind of a quasi-flex office that was really built more to be office space. And then when there was a need for office space, you had to tear it all out, which would then destroy value. And at that point, it said, do we really want to operate against a very tightly constructed world of the Prologis and some of the other firms that operate so much better in that space? So then it came down to the retail. And the retail is what I thought was the most fascinating aspect for two reasons. One, most of the assets were in Houston. Houston is a very diverse culture. It's global. Also, it has a global position in the market. There's also a really broad depth of education and with the workforce as well. And in studying this, the product that was in this portfolio was actually focused on a culturally diverse community. So we had a broad, very, very broad portfolio of different communities that we were serving. At the same time, because of where we were, the people that we were hiring, we had also a globally diverse community of employees as well. So we had about 26 languages spoken. So yeah. I thought this was a really unique opportunity to position ourselves differently in the market. And at the same time, it dovetailed into what I was doing at school. At that point, I studied quite a bit about retail. I was always fascinated about it. We had other portfolios of retail as well. I had some experience managing, leasing, building retail. And I saw that there was a change in opportunity in the sense of what I saw is a lot of fat tail risk. So I had also finished this book, Anti-Fragility, The Things That Gain from Disorder by Taleb. And it talked about really fat tail risk. So if you think about, this is in 2006, and you know, we went through this financial crisis, and there was this mindset of this concentrated risk that was going on. So I used that time to understand what was the concentration of risk in retail. And what I saw is that there was a mindset of tenant credit and big. So you had fortress malls, you had power centers, and I'm watching this coincide at the same time with Amazon. And I thought, this is not going to work, right? You know, this concentration of soft goods and hard goods and big, and at the same time, everything is going online. And how is this going to play out? And quite frankly, I think we know where it played out now. So where I like dispersion of risk, right? And so for me, statistically, I was looking for dispersion of risk versus this was an overlay of fat tail risk. And you started to see the dominoes, right? With the fat tail swinging, the dominoes started to fall during the crisis. So that was number one. And the second thing that I saw too is just the movement away from the coast. So again, there was a mindset in, particularly with retail, is that you wanted to be on either coast. You want to be towards New York, you want to be LA, California, San Francisco, because real estate was heavily restricted as far as the ability to develop. So it was very constrained as far as development costs, so on and so forth. And I thought, well, I'd rather have unconstrained growth versus constrained supply. And with that, I started looking at communities growth. So going in Chicago, I was also seeing what was happening in Chicago at the time. It was becoming a very, I grew up in the Midwest, it was becoming a very difficult environment to grow a business. And with that study, I started looking at Texas. And it happened to coincide at the time when this portfolio became available. And so we focused on Texas first in the market, and then we started looking at similar markets around it. So in Texas, we're in Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Fort Worth, Austin. And then eventually we also, because of the great financial crisis, or GFC as they're calling it, started focusing on Phoenix as well, which was a great time and opportunity to do so because we had a number of great buys early on in 2010, 11, 12, 13, 14.
So Christine, you played a role in Whitestone's IPO. Do you want to tell us a little about that?
Yeah, there was another, boy, talk about a nail-biting experience. So, you think of coming out, again, 2006, you're going into the financial crisis, 2007, 2008, and, you know, there's such a capital constraint back then. So fortunately, we were able to get our debt stack in place. So whenever you come into a challenged and troubled company, you have four C's that you have to do. So the first thing is you have to have control, which we did. We had a board of directors, and then we had some member of our team on the board. That was number one. Number two, you really had to get the capital stack in place, especially then. So fortunately, we were able to get our debt in place. And then going public, get our IPO. Now, talk about that in a moment. And then the next thing is you have to define the company. And the company is one of the things that, again, we looked at saying, we're going to go towards retail. And how are we going to communicate this value proposition with retail? And then the final is the culture. And the culture takes a lot longer time to build and really ingraining the values of the company and the culture. And that's something that we started to do as well back then. So now going public in 2010, again, capital constrained environment, especially with real estate, and having to define the company, we saw two opportunities to do so. The one is, again, to talk about this risk factor of big. So we talked about the beauty in small and also talked about the beauty of being in our markets, pro-growth markets, the ability to do business in a very business-friendly environment. At that time, it was Texas. We are also looking, again, we're deploying this capital in Arizona. We're able to say, here's where we think the value proposition was in Arizona. In particular, we're looking at the East Valley Corridor, which people think at that point in time, they think of as Arizona as a community of retirees. And doing the study, I was seeing that Arizona is actually getting younger, and especially on that East Corridor, a lot of that had to do with the growth of ASU. So you're starting to see a much younger population moving and staying there. So that also led to that focus as well. So there's one more thing that we were able to check the box with that the investors were looking for at the time. And that, again, was that cultural diversity. And so we were the first REIT to go out with a community-centered portfolio that had community centers, right? So a little bit different at the time. Now it's really in vogue. But back then, it was a little bit of struggle. I think we went out with one of the smallest IPOs of $26 million. So it'll give you an indication of how difficult it was to get out. But one of the early investors was Fidelity, so we always appreciate that they took a chance on us.
Excellent. So I know you played a lot of different roles at the firm since then. Do you want to walk us through a couple of those? And I know you mentioned a few minutes ago a lot of nail-biting experiences. I imagine that COVID was one of those. You want to tell us a little about that?
Sure. I think First of all, when you have a small and growing company, you wear a lot of hats. And fortunately, I've had experience over the years of being able to head to be on the operating side, to be in the public markets, to do organizational change, things that work in restructurings and workouts. So a lot of those things helped contribute to what I was able to do at the company at that point. In addition, in the very early beginnings of the company, here I was in grad school and I was working with professors at that time that I was able to get a lot of advisory and counsel from them along the way because the early start was very difficult as well. So not only getting the company stabilized and getting it established, but at the same time, you had to build a new team as well because unfortunately, some of the team members that came along didn't really come alongside the culture that we're building. That provided a lot of opportunity for me organizationally to build the departments within the company and a number of platforms that we're doing. So number one, the acquisitions platform. The most important thing was to try to define what type of properties we were going to buy. And so the first is that we saw this opportunity to buy smaller properties. So about below 150,000 square feet and a little bit bigger than 50,000 square feet. It positioned us competitively from two reasons. One is anything that was 150 and below, institutions weren't looking at those opportunities. They were too small for them. And at the same time, anything from 50,000 square feet and below that, we were competing against local investors. So there was just this real great opportunity with looking at a little bit bigger than where you would be able to compete on a property. It was maybe over 10 million, but at the same time, up to 25 to maybe 50 million didn't attract the institutional investors. So that gave us a lot of running room to acquire. In addition to that, we were acquiring in Arizona heavily. And at that point, we had to build a team around that as well. So we were one of the only bidders. There was another bidder that was in the market that was Bob Parsons with GoDaddy. He was the one competitor that we had, and he could easily stroke a check. So we had to be very defined in what type of property we were buying and then how we were able to be able to secure those assets. So Arizona now is probably our largest market. It's about 40% of our revenues. We're able to, again, buy a lot of those assets during the GFC. At the same time, you had to build a team to be able to focus appropriately with the culture and the environment. So the easiest thing I had to do at that point was just call anybody from the Midwest and during February and say, hey, you want to come down to Phoenix? It's really great down here. And of course, there's shoveling snow. And it was really easy to sort of lure what I consider talent from the Midwest into that market to build a team. And then on the other side in Houston, we're starting to diversify out of that market as well and much more in Dallas. And then we bought into Austin. And that, again, we got ahead of where the rest of the crowd was. And we also started to really looking strategically. So I had used a platform called Esri. Esri is one of the largest mapping systems in the world. It's still owned privately by a couple of the Dangermans out of California. And they had this, it was called a psychographics that you could use. And it was fascinating to be able to understand your community beyond the demography of the community. So we really focused on what we considered upwardly mobile communities and affordable areas. And that led us to a market where I saw that the HHIs, the household incomes were growing. And with those household incomes, we were also looking to see where we were best positioning for the traffic to capture those incomes. We consider anchoring different. When people think of an anchor, they traditionally think of a grocery store. We look at the community and say the community anchors our center. And it's focusing on where those opportunities are with the community, with the demography of spend, what their aspirations are, generally, what is it that they're looking for in life? How do they consume? All that information that you can gather with psychographics, then we would pursue centers in those areas. And in addition to that, we stayed really close to demand drivers like job growth, so on and so forth, focused in states that had a growing demography to them. So Texas and Arizona turned out to be really prescient. And then in addition to that, business-friendly environments, but then also communities that had that upward mobility. That's where we really dialed into other centers and then took advantage of size, right, from a strategic direction. And most of our centers we serve, we focus more on local and regional tenants than we do on nationals, which also is a competitive advantage. And then I can go into COVID next because this is where the business model really proved out.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Now we get into COVID, right? And so first of all, it's everybody at that point in time, the first thing that we had to deal with is just the uncertainty and the fear. No doubt, as we saw this rolling at first, it hit the coast first. And I'll never forget when we had our first case of COVID in one of our centers and it got reported. And boy, you know, we knew the world was going to change. And first thing you're doing, right, everybody's getting Zoom, they're moving off site, they're moving to home. And at that point, you're dealing with an intense fear of what does the future look like? And so the decision was made is that we were going to have meetings at 1 o'clock and we were going to broaden. So every day we on Zoom, we were at 1 o'clock and we broadened the leadership to not just the top leaders in the company, but all the way really to middle management for a while because we wanted everybody on the same page. And then the next was, as we said, we're going to talk about only a few things only, because if you let fear take a hold, it's really hard to control. So the decision I thought in leading these meetings was going to be, we're going to focus first on our client contact, staying in touch with our tenants. First and foremost, that's what we're going to do. And the second is we're going to really make sure that we manage our cash tightly. And we started doing right away Monte Carlo simulations. We started bucketing where we thought tenants were in the progression of payment and so on and so forth through this time. So stayed very, very tight with that and also our workforce. In addition, didn't matter what your job was, we were going to pair up. So we had a series of times. So we, over this time period, which I always think of in the beginning was, you know, the first week when this happened and everybody started closing down in our markets, going through to about June. So this is really, for us, it really started hitting in April. Like it came in the first week of April and then to June. We had a series of 6 very highly choreographed communications that we had with our clients, our tenants. And with that, we always made sure that we had 2 people on the phone. We didn't want people to be alone in this process. We wanted them to be supported, whether it's leasing, property management, accounting team members, the acquisitions team members, they all were together on the call, you know, in pairs of 2s where they're communicating with our clients at that point. And the first thing was just to make sure that their stores were protected. All right. So we worked with them to make sure were things locked. Was anything in the window that you needed to move back from the window? Because we didn't know if there was going to be theft or we had no idea what was going to happen. We wanted to make sure we protected their businesses. That was number one. And then number 2, then we didn't even talk about rents. There wasn't even, not even the thought about in the category to even speak about that. Then the second was to say, hey, if you're an essential business, can we get you open? And how do we get you open? And can we help expand your business in some way? So at some point, restaurants and some other activities were allowed to be open. Then the question was, okay, can we give them outdoor space? What can we do to keep them engaged? And since we worked with local and regional operators, there was a lot of customer switching because the nationals, you know, the decisions were being made out of the East Coast or the West Coast. And with that, they were on lockdown. So you had a lot of customer switching that happened.
We had no idea what was happening in Arizona and Texas.
Oh, it was amazing, right? It was amazing. Like we were encouraged, like you can get open. You can be the one that can capture that customer that's just looking to get out. And at the same time, we took on Placer, which helped us. Placer is another thing, uses your phones to do basically location analytics. So we could find out where traffic was traveling to, where it was coming from, how much traffic was coming to our centers. And that opened the door, again, for a number of our clients in particular to gain new customer base. With that, we then helped with PPP. So we started even, they couldn't get into their bank. We started working with local banks. And what I saw during that time is that businesses, especially the businesses we worked with, really strengthened their business models. We had very few failures. We had very little blend and extend. If anything, we were already pulling out of this in, I would say, late 2020. In the first quarter of 2021, we are already seeing a huge demand in some of our space for people that are coming from other states looking to really save their businesses, right? So it was a real opportunity for us to grow as a company as well. It makes some decisions that we needed to make that hadn't been made. This is, again, I never let a crisis go to waste, opportunity. And I think it strengthened us. It proved the business model. We were topping collections. In addition, you know, we were able to tighten down things that we saw that needed to happen within the company as far as alignment and positioned us for success rolling out of it. So thankful for the team for sticking by us during that time. It was pretty scary for a lot of people.
I totally understand it. A personal anecdote, I was working for a retail REIT myself during that time, and it felt like all we were doing was checking on Placer traffic week on week to see who was going where. But yeah. So I wanted to ask one follow-up question. You know, you gave a nice profile of some of the centers that you guys have looked after for the last few years. You're 50 to 150,000 in these areas with upwardly mobile folks. I get the sense the type of centers you guys have been after have remained fairly similar. But has the strategy in the execution changed over the last few years? Was COVID a motivator for that? Or has the company remained pretty consistent?
Well, I think we've been consistent regarding who it is that we like to lease to. We have stayed focused on local. We've stayed focused on regional. I think the most important thing, though, it allowed the company to position and align in particular where I say is quality of revenue. And so that's where we really started dialing into. What defines revenue quality in the company? That also led us to do a data dive to see where the best performers were, especially during COVID, but even prior to COVID, where was the strength in operators and what we were looking for? And I think that for us in particular, because there's this mindset out there, and it bothers me that's even out there because being an entrepreneur myself, but these mom and pops, right? And it just bothers me. Nobody builds a business nowadays to stay small. They build it to grow. They build it for opportunity for themselves, for family. I've seen that with all of our entrepreneurs. And there's very few mom and pops even. I just don't, this mom and pops, I'm like, that's a 50s term, just like housewife, you know, even small business. So you remember when Starbucks used to talk about, and they used to call it a short latte and they changed it to tall, right? Well, I always say it's the same thing. I don't believe in small businesses. I look at tall growing businesses. And with that, we've focused in on operators that have shown the ability to scale. What I'm finding is people that are building businesses now, they're coming into it with a lot more experience than they used to have. You know, in the past, I think sometimes you saw a default to building a business because, you know, you wanted to be your own boss, and now entrepreneurs are building businesses because they see an opportunity. It's a different mindset. They're much more professionalized now. In particular, I've always liked underwriting restaurants in particular because you saw that in what's the biggest competition for grocery stores? Well, it's restaurants. And what's the biggest competition now for people's time? Well, it's just being able to time manage with the amount of things that you have to do to run a family nowadays. In many cases, where we saw this opportunity in particular with food, so about 28% of our revenues come from grocery and restaurants, that I've just seen this professionalization that's happened in the space, not only with just point of sale, with business plans, just even the franchises that are out there now are providing much better platforms for businesses to grow. So we really aligned into that model, saw the strength of those operators during COVID, and that's who we actively seek out to be part of our communities. Plus, they understand the community better than anybody else because most of the time they live in the community. They live there or they really understand their local environments and they stay much more regional. And when they get that model working, they know how to partner up well to scale.
I suspect now that because it's so easy to get your hands on some of the kind of AI tools to even think about some of these things like analyzing a lease agreement or putting a business plan together, that these quote mom and pops, quite easy for them to scale more so than it would have been in a previous environment. Now, I want to back up a little bit because I know you've spent a lot of your career advising and operating in the capital market space, and I think we're in a really interesting time. High interest rates, it seems like inflation is back on the table, consumer behavior is changing pretty rapidly. What do you make of this, and where do you see Whitestone fitting in there?
Well, I think there's a couple of things that are pretty exciting. I always look for times like this where you have volatility. Again, I came as a trader, so where you made money was from when the markets were volatile, right?
Absolutely.
not that I'm encouraging it, but I'm just saying that's where you have pockets of opportunity. I think most of all, during this time, we shouldn't be too surprised with inflation for a couple of reasons. If you look at over time, prior to this, we had sort of a deflationary environment for quite a long period of time. This reminds me a little bit of the 80s. So when you think of the timing of the boomers and when they were coming into their spending patterns, it was in the 80s. My dad and I always talk about this. You know, he's always like, Dad, what is this? He's 83, but he's young, young thinker. He's, you know, he always looks back at history and goes, this is like the 80s and the early 90s. And then as you had this period of high growth, a lot of consumer spend, and with that, you have a lot of consumption. So we have a somewhat similar thing today. It's just a delayed consumption pattern that's been coming from the millennials and the generation behind them. Why? Because they were impacted greatly, really, because of the cost of education and the lack of housing that they've had. So I think that we should expect that some of this is going to continue and not be too surprised by it, not just because we had a restriction with COVID and the ability for the supply chain to act appropriately, also with a lot of money coming into the space, but you have a new demography that's spending, and they're spending differently. So I think this is here to stay for a bit. Can we expect that we're going to see a spike, 5-6% inflation? No, but I think in the 2.5 to 3.5 ranges, you know, was the norm in the 90s. And I think we should continue to expect it and look at the prior time as being somewhat the abnormality. Interest rate, same thing. I think the market hates uncertainty, right? But we're starting to see things temper down a little bit. But I'm also seeing some interesting clouds coming on the horizon that might make things interesting too. So, you know, I want to position for those as well.
Yeah, I think those generational shifts are really incredible. I just got back from a conference in Vegas last week, Shop Talk, and one of the things that popped up in every session was that Gen Z bears kind of an odd resemblance to the boomers, and that they're coming out of this period that maybe entering their prime spending years where they were locked away during COVID, and they're slated to have trillions in spending power by 2030. But what's interesting about them is that they share an affinity for in-person retail. I wonder if you have any thoughts on that, or maybe if they're so fundamentally different than the generation after them, Gen Alpha. I want you to tell me a little bit about what you think about those generational trends.
Oh, I get so excited about this next generation just because, well, I mean, they're a little bit more conservative, I think, than their parents, right? They've been through some pretty significant stressors in their life. And so they do approach things a little bit differently in their spending patterns. And I also think you take that, and when people think about retail, they always think about, we in retail have to define this better. But when people think of retail, automatically they think of the mall, they think of power centers, they think of hard goods and soft goods. And retail is much broader. It's a much broader category than that. It's, you know, a space where you sell a product, a service, or product and a service. And I think when you think about things that way, then you have a better understanding of retail. And so what we're seeing in particular in this environment is that group and the one ahead of it, they're looking much more for experiences. They're, of course, much more engaged with their phones. So anything that you have to do, or a customer base that you're appealing to in this, you have to have a digital footprint. And you really have to know how to market yourself. And just as a side note, one of the things I'm fascinated with this generation is they're so used to selling themselves online. They're really good salespeople. So, right? They're really good. And so I find this kind of fascinating because many of them, when they know how to drive revenue for themselves at such a young age, guess what? They're forming businesses at a young age too. And so we're starting to see that we're finding these new businesses much more service related. We're seeing health, wellness, beauty. That is probably one of our top categories of growth. It doesn't seem to be slowing down. I'm always fascinated by wellness and the focus towards that now, how broad of a category that is, whether it's mental wellness to physical wellness. It's just a plethora of opportunities to serve this community. On the other side of that as well, I find that communicating to them is really important, right? So again, that's that digital footprint, how you communicate to them and then how they communicate to you, because they're especially talkative, right? this constant back and forth. So where I see that is really important is in that space, but I'm seeing another change as well. And this really started this year. And that is that dry January is extending. They're kind of a healthy group in a way already, but now they're doubling down on health. And this is somewhat, I think, similar to the Surgeon General is saying smoking's bad for you. You're hearing so much about alcohol being bad for you. So you're seeing them go towards the cavas. They still love caffeine. That hasn't changed. But they're starting to taper off their alcohol consumption. With that, they're also looking for reasons to get together. So again, how do we address that in our community space, our restaurants? How do we focus that? We're providing the right opportunities for them to connect, because the phone, in a great way for them to stay connected, is still not the same as a physical connection. So It's a fascinating group to serve. It's been fun also to hire them as an employee as well as our teammates, because again, it's a whole new world of discovery to see how they think and what's important to them as well.
Yeah, I hadn't made that connection before that when I was doing some leasing work back in the day, that a lot of the centers that were in communities dominated by boomers, they love the kind of service oriented, your bakeries, your flower shops, your cell phone stores, all that. And I could see the connection between that and what some of the kind of Gen Z clientele is looking for too.
Oh, and especially I look into coffee. That's the big one. Like Starbucks is getting a little, like the old gal's getting a little old there. And, you know, you look at La La Land and where you got these pretty coffee drinks that are Instagrammable, Dutch Brothers, which is super funky and cool. You're seeing these generational choices of shifts, and how well does a retailer shift towards that type of consumer? Those are the ones that we're looking for, by the way, that are scalable, that we see the best opportunities for bringing them in. So when we discover them and discover their business models, we tightly bond with them and look to engage with their growth in our communities.
So I want to ask you about some other trends that are maybe happening in this space. Are you seeing anything interesting across your portfolio that others might not see if they just read about the retail space online?
Yeah, I think that what is still really important. So two things that I just say I should comment about this is having the right space and being flexible is also important. And I do think that others are starting to discover this as well, that our average size space is around 2,500 to 3,000 square feet. It is the most easy to position to a wide variety of uses, and it's the most cost-effective as well to also position to other uses. But I do see that others are starting to catch on to it. What I don't see is that people are still looking to successfully serve the community. Again, with our team, the number one thing that we always say is that you have to successfully serve the community. So that means understanding that community, finding the right businesses to serve that community, and then that business must be successful as well. We have to provide that platform to be successful. When we think about this, again, to our communities, it's some of it, like I'm starting to see, it's fascinating, is that anything like Asian right now seems to have sort of an interesting dynamic to it. And this has been going on for a while. And in particular, we're in Houston. So we're already in an area that has a very large Asian community. But I'm starting to see these concepts when it comes to food or Daiso. These are kind of new, cool, and hip. And, you know, starting to not just be in the places where we serve an Asian community, but also just a broader community as well. One other one I see too is just, and it's both sides of the barbell that I find, again, fascinating, is certain types of fitness that serves not only a more senior crowd. So, for example, stretch, Pilates, things that keep you healthier longer. That's both sides of the barbell because people are staying physically active for longer, and a younger generation that comes from Title IX, having played sports, you know, through school, which I did myself, and more women do. So you got a broad, you know, indication of women and men that are both in sports, that this is just part of the dynamic of being physically active. So we're seeing that the right kind of businesses know how to tailor to a demographic that's older, that wants to stay in shape, but also to a younger demographic that believes in physical activity. So one of our favorite ones that we love is pickleball. Why do we like it? And we were one of the early, I think, we jumped into this early, this trend, and for two reasons. One, we saw that it was interesting seeing the customer for it. And it turned out that during COVID, it was young men. Young men were looking for a place to go. They're working from home, in particular engineers, and they were looking for a place to engage with others. So we looked at this dynamic. We thought pickleball was just for retirees. Oh, no, 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 that's not the case. How do you make money in it? You create indoor pickleball. You find a way to engage a community that wants to be socially active and to meet others. And you do it inside, so you have consistency of play, and voila, we're seeing this huge move into that sport. So that we're not seeing it just for there. Say, I think of pickleball as being a downsized tennis court. We're seeing other resizing of sports as well. So the same thing, short field soccer, we are seeing engagement with different leagues out there that it doesn't, that you're playing well beyond your college years and into much later in life. It's about not just staying physically active, but also community as well, that community connection. So, you know, interesting, fun spaces to be in to discover these things, because you have to be very, you have to observe and you have to look for it, right? And when you discover, you want to get early on the train with this, figure out how they make money first so you know they can be successful, and then grab them, you know, grab those, get into those relationships with the right operators early.
Great. So I do want to round out our conversation with some broader questions. And I know we've talked a little bit about some of the kind of immediate consumer trends that you're looking at, but thinking maybe 5 to 10 years down the road, what are some consumer trends that you're paying really close attention to, or you think that folks in CRE or retail need to be looking at?
I think the most important thing, and this is out there, but it's housing, right? It's really unfortunate to see a generation that can't build wealth through their homes, right? So what I would assume is that we're going to continue to see this shifting change and the opportunity for housing for people to be not only upwardly mobile in their communities, but also in building wealth as well. And along with that comes a certain kind of consumption. So to me, I'm always curious to see what home builders are building and why. It's interesting to me. And I look at anything that relates to health, right? For example, I find it interesting right now that this whole thing, what I consider the hot and cold factor, right? So into doing cold dips and blending it with sauna, infrared saunas, right? Again, this is more of a holistic view of health and healing that people are continuing to look for themselves. I think my biggest concern that I think about, and Cigna did a really good study and a follow-on study on this, and that's loneliness. I always look and say, what can we do in retail to bring people together? How can we help solve this problem of people being lonely? And it seems like this is getting worse. It doesn't seem to be getting better. How is it when we're so independent that we can actually bring the opportunity of actually having some dependency on each other, right? And that dependency might just be what we used to call in kindergarten, parallel play, just being near by somebody else and knowing you're not physically alone is a start. And then how do we continue to engage with those connections? So again, we're always looking to see how can we get ahead of the curve on being able to solve that problem. And even though it may seem like a small part of it, but I do believe in many cases, our retail centers are the living room of a community. We're the place that sometimes is the living room, the dining room, the playroom even, right? And we can be sometimes the front door to that community too. When we think about our centers, that is that handshake into the community, that retail that's there, how it looks, how it feels, is that introduction into a community. So I just think about that in the sense of holistically, where do we place ourselves with those trends to be positioned appropriately for those needs?
And I could certainly see how if you have one generation over here that's locked out of either home ownership or kind of in smaller homes, and you have another over here that finds it quite easy to be entertained at home.
Yeah.
It's extremely important to create these spaces where folks come together. And if you're good at it, you can make a lot of money doing it. I think there's a couple other questions I wanted to ask you here. I think there's a lot of talk about economic uncertainty. As we're recording this, I think tariffs may or may not go into effect. There's people worried about the health of the consumer. What do you think about all that? And where does retail fit into this story? Not all of your centers are purely dry goods retailers, as we've been talking about here, but what do you think about all that?
So we're just trying to keep a pulse on what's happening. So we talk, always are being engaged with our tenants. So one of the things that we have with our property management team is we say that's not just about administrating to a property. In fact, it's that community engagement that we rely heavily on with our property managers. And much of that, again, is to stay in touch with our tenants to say, are we seeing shifting business patterns, behavior, so on and so forth, and just to get ahead of those trends. And so, again, we talked a little bit about some of the shifting in the pattern of spending, especially at our restaurants. You know, when I always think about food and fashion are the quickest in turnover and product type, food in particular. And so we watch and say, what are they doing? How are they shifting? It's the most interesting one I see is that steakhouses were the big thing for a while. That's where a lot of the big spend was in restaurants. It's actually moving away from that. It's moving to a little bit more affordable spend. This is an area that we like to focus on quite a bit and stay towards an area where, you know, the ticket is anywhere from $20 to $60 instead of over $100 per person in our restaurant space. So it stays affordable and you can keep a customer sticky and coming back to what I consider their local watering hole, right? Or that special event that they may also come there and not always have to figure out that you're doing a high-end per plate dinner. And I think the other thing that we're finding, and I'm a little worried about this too, it's just there's a lot of drive-throughs, right? And so I'm starting to see this in retail that instead of staying engaged with the walkable community, we're seeing that there's this plethora of restaurants and drive-throughs coming in. Although that's not bad, but it just implies that it's whether it's Grubhub or you're having delivery or you're picking up a drive-through, it's not bad that the food comes home, but is it communal? So again, staying ahead of trying to make sure that we manage towards those trends and the right type of mix is important. And that's also one of the things that we find in retail. I should just give as a side note too, is that, you know, we're still a car culture. How you manage your parking counts at a center is very, very important. And then blending your merchandise mix so that you get the best value for an 18-hour day. We've even started bringing into some of our centers, we have some kind of clients that are more like office-like. Why are they there? Because they want to work close to where they live, right? And they want to be able to just drive out, go into the office, be able to gain a platform for talent because you have amenities at your space. So again, we're kind of keep moving into these trends and opportunities of what, where can we position differently for those community needs?
Retail is quite a bit different than a lot of the other real estate asset classes. A lot of our listeners kind of play in the institutional space and are super familiar with office, industrial, and apartment. How does retail position itself relative to the other asset classes? I know most people think maybe it's just big box and mall, but I think if they listen to our conversation today, they'd know that's not the case. It's a lot more. How about you tell us about its kind of relative value there?
So I think, first of all, it's a different asset classes go. It was funny to think that in the 90s, industrial and multifamily were like considered boring and people, people didn't really like to invest in those. They wanted beautiful office buildings and malls. And as it shifted, those have become the hottest products out there. And they'll continue, right? You still need more housing. So multifamily, even though it may have taken a little bit of a down note, I think that's very short term. Distribution, especially with the whole movement towards offshoring to back into inshoring again with this administration. And it started during COVID and they're leaning into it even more. So distribution is going to continue to be hot. That being said, retail, because of the challenges that we faced 15 years ago, the great financial crisis, with Amazon coming on, people were afraid to build retail. So not enough of it was being built. It's so now, mentioned this earlier about this younger generation wanting to come back to touching and feeling and seeing things. And again, coming together around those spaces, there's not enough of it. It's the demand is far outstripping the supply of retail right now. And as you said earlier too, the challenge was with tariffs, it makes it even more difficult to build. And it's creating more uncertainty amongst the retailers themselves how to position for this. So you've got a couple of things happening here. The supply-demand curve's out of whack. It's much more demand, not enough supply. The difficulty of bringing on more supply is very challenging because the cost to build and tariffs. And at the same time, you have the retailers, if they're going to grow, right? So that their challenge is part of their growth is making sure that they have a higher store count, but they're also trying to manage to this uncertainty with the tariff protection. So this environment is a little like I wouldn't call it wobbly because people are still spending. We're not seeing a shutdown in spending. We're just seeing that it's creating a little bit of volatility of what type of retail is going to be easy to build going forward. I think that's part of the reason why we're getting a lot of pads because they're easy, right? And, you know, how do we build the right size retail to newer markets or to existing markets? Where can we bring it into the space? Whether it's mixed use, you're seeing some of it there. You're seeing some of it come through in as far as newly developed communities, that retail has to be a part of it because that's attraction to the community. But again, there's a bit of the conundrum of how affordable is it to actually develop the product. But it's a bit of a challenge right now.
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't want to make too much of a hard pivot here. I think one of the reasons that you're good at what you do is because you have a pulse on what the kind of up and coming generations are doing. And I think that's in part because you do teach a lot of them. So I do want to ask with our last few minutes here, we have a lot of listeners that are trying to break into the CRE space, either coming out of school or in a graduate program. Do you have any advice for folks trying to break into the industry?
Yeah, it's a difficult industry. As big as it is, you would think it'd be easy to get into. It's actually quite a challenge. Most of the people that I find that do enter the space, it's either through a family relationship or a friend that knows a family that's in the business. I get this with my graduate students as well. How do we get into this? And I think if you have the opportunity, as you're younger, it's always usually to come into it as an analyst so you can learn how you make money in the space is a very important thing to do. So how the sausage is made, so to speak, is important to know, number one. But the second, I think that's always look for is if you could come into, you always should really try to position in any business knowing how to drive revenue, not to service the business, but to drive revenue. So that would usually be in a leasing position or an acquisition. So I would try to dial in either through as an analyst, or I would start with a smaller firm where you're in either one of those two roles, or you're learning behind somebody that's very, very strong in those roles. You got JLL, CBRE, that you also have smaller local developers that you get a lot of experience right away with, wearing a lot of hats. But our business is made up of contracts and it's asset heavy, right? So you have to understand the financials before you get in. So I definitely advise towards understanding how the sausage is made, what determines profitability before you come into the space, and then enter in one of those three areas.
I think that's excellent advice. So I do have one last question for you. We ask this to all of our guests, and that is, if you could snap your fingers and have any change come to the industry, what would that be?
Oh, I think this again goes, how do we define ourselves? I think that the challenge that we're facing in particular, having coming out of a very challenging time, the great financial crisis, then with Amazon, we're just not defining ourselves as a much broader category. And I think if we would do that, financing would be better. There'd be better understanding, greater understanding of how the product operates. It is one of the more complicated asset classes because when you're building out space, you're building it for a variety of users and you have to build it to be flexible as well. So I think that I'd snap my fingers and be say, let's define ourselves beyond soft goods and hard goods. Retail is really all about that corner, that location that's there, that's convenient for that community to access, whether it's goods, services, connect with your communities. That's really what I see retail. And going back to the days of old where you had, you know, the blacksmith, the local store on the cross corner, or being at a wharf at that point in time where goods and services were transpiring. So I think it gets back to defining who we are and what we do. I think we have to do a better job.
Christine, thank you so much for being with us. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in, and take care until the next episode of CRE Exchange. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the CRE Exchange podcast powered by Altus Group. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a 5-star review and be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. This episode is brought to you by Altus Group, a global leader in asset and fund intelligence for commercial real estate. At Altus, we bring together capabilities across technology, analytics, valuations, tax, and development advisory services. We are guided by bold thinking, integrity, and inclusivity, partnering with CRE professionals to maximize opportunities with exceptional service experience. Find out more at altusgroup.com.